We're also joined by Rhode Island Public Radio political analyst Scott McKay. Hello, Scott.
Good morning, everyone.
Bob, there were a lot of public employee union members who were upset about not getting more information during the recent process leading to the proposed pension settlement. Did you lead your membership down?
No, I'm very happy with the amount of information we provided to our members in the pension settlement discussions. I do observe that there's still a huge education process that we have to undertake even after settlement. A lot of folks still don't know what benefits they used to have or they currently have, and I get that. It used to be a turnkey operation. Most folks, wherever they are in life, don't necessarily pay strict attention to what their future benefits are. But we provided, you know, from the get-go, a lot of information. It was easy to write my columns about it because I could quote myself from prior columns, reminding them that we had already talked about certain things, including the case.
Before we go to Scott, I'd like to get your take on the gag order that was imposed by Superior Court Judge Sarah Taft Carter. Was that a mistake for the judge to impose the gag order?
I don't think it was a mistake. I could have lived with either decision. It doesn't matter to me. I would be happy to talk to you during the process. It would have been another distraction, and you would have been handling a lot of bits and pieces information that weren't necessarily accurate. But it's not unusual during a negotiations process, and this was behind-the-scenes negotiations trying to get settlement for something like that to be in effect. And everything gets to be fully vetted now. There will be legislation. There'll be fairness hearings before the court. I think that in the pre-Twitter age of media, this would not have been as big a deal as it was in the current environment.
Do you think it was an impediment or a help as far as getting a settlement?
Probably helped somewhat. You know, we could fully communicate with our members. I was mad at the ACLU for going to court saying, well, the members can't be informed. We fully communicated with our members. One of my 4-page documents was leaked to a member of the media outlining exactly what our thinking was on it. So it showed we were fully communicating with our membership. But it did at least give us the ability to avoid a constant barrage of questions that might have been off topic and dealing with rumors and whatnot. So, yeah, it was probably mildly helpful.
The settlement, if it goes forward, will cost taxpayers about another $32 million per year. How do you expect the state to pay for that?
There are a couple of different ways that they can pay for it. I would probably take the governor's perspective on this. The settlement going forward is going to save taxpayers, $100 million a year and look at it from that perspective. But it can be either within or outside the pension system. Within the pension system, the tried and true way, I don't think they should change the rate of return. I don't think they should change the actuarial data. It's either re-amortize within the pension system or look to revenue sources outside of it, which would be tax revenues in one form or another. That's it. Those are the only buckets you can look at.
We're having a robust debate once again about the role of charter schools. I'm wondering from your perspective, what's the proper function and what's the proper part of charter schools in our education mix, our public education mix?
Quoting a friend of mine from back when, charter schools should be tugboats moving all of public education in a better direction, not lifeboats that a few kids get to bail out into. The original design of charter schools was exactly that. We have some ideas. Let's try them out. If they work, let's immediately incorporate them back into the system at large, or have a one-off unique situation where a charter is uniquely designed to deal with a specific circumstance. Unfortunately, that has evolved into, hey kids, let's have a charter school idea, and that doesn't always meet the needs of public education. Right now, they're draining funding from the traditional public schools. Anyone who believes in school consolidation, well, the news is we went from 37 districts to 61 because each charter is its own independent island competing for resources, draining needed resources from the schools. When the journal's editorializing against, I know it costs a lot of money, but still let's do this, you know that we finally struck a nerve and we can't afford to do both. Let's put those resources into the traditional public schools.
Some of these charter schools just a smokescreen for trying to have more privatization of public education?
Some of these second and third generation charters have that corporate taint about them. Some of the original charters were formed by folks with good purpose, true believers in education, and really trying to make a difference. And I'm not inherently opposed to charter schools. I think we need a thoughtful pause. I think we need a moratorium on the expansion until we can figure all of this out. But the drain in resources is real and significant. The Cumberland school system alone loses millions a year, taking away from their existing programs within their existing system to go to the charter schools.
We're talking here with Robert Walsh of the National Education Association Rhode Island Union. Bob, we see this pension settlement and also how your union's preferred gubernatorial candidate, Clay Pell, did not win the Democratic primary last year. Are we seeing a waning of the political power of unions in Rhode Island?
No, I don't think. Well, first of all, in the gubernatorial race, I suppose we were waxing and waning at the same time, since you had unions in all three camps, and one of our camps prevailed. The Democratic candidate prevailed for the first time in a very long time in the state. So I would say that there's always somebody in labor in Rhode Island that's in the ball game, and we've come together since then. Certainly, the pension situation was tough. If I had the time machine, we would have fixed this back in the '80s, so it never occurred, and things got out of control. I don't see that as a reflection on the power of the labor movement as much as the fiscal realities. As victory was not going to be getting everything back. There were some fiscal realities that showed a hard wall. Our complaint was, we have a contract and there were more reasonable ways to do it. Contract was upheld and we found a more reasonable way to do it. I'm not claiming victory, but I'm saying that's what we said and that's what happened.
You are well acquainted with former House Speaker Gordon Fox, who's facing a prison sentence after pleading guilty to corruption charges. How surprised were you by the details that came out about his involvement in corruption?
Well, I was heartbroken. Gordon had been a friend of mine since the 1980s. I remember when he first ran for city council in the mid-80s, and then his first run for the House in 92, I think it was, and I supported him then. You know, what's the saying about absolute power? I don't know. My father had a saying about forgetting your roots, and maybe simply forgot his roots and tried to live at a level beyond his means. But I'm just shocked and saddened by it. I still see in his heart of hearts a decent person there who got led astray.
I'm wondering what you think the future is for your friend and somebody you supported very strongly, Clay Pell. What do you think his Rhode Island political future, if any, is?
Oh, I think he's got a very bright political future if he chooses to pursue a political future in Rhode Island. He's got a bright future in just about anything he chooses to pursue. He and his wife, Michelle, plan to make their home right here in Rhode Island. I think he's a multi-talented individual who can pretty much handle anything that's thrown at him. I wish he bragged more upon himself, as they say, during his campaign and told some of the stories of the things he did when he worked in the White House or in the Coast Guard or everything else. He's a terrific individual, and I think the world of him, of course.
To bring it full circle back to pensions, you held up the lack of a definitive decision in the pension case as a good thing for unions. Are you confident that the state is not going to try and make further changes to the pension system in the future?
Well, I think the standard's still the same, that we have contractual protections, and the state would have to make a case, ultimately meet a reasonableness case if there was a greater government purpose to do so. The pension system was, you know, the numbers were pretty bad. There's just no denying that. I would have gotten there on a slower boat to get it fixed than the now governor had proposed, but it did need to be addressed. I think that it's on the right path now, but there are no guarantees in anything. The government, shockingly, and this is hard for our folks who are used to the contract being sacrosanct, the government can take your land by eminent domain. They can look at you and say, I'm sending you to a foreign country to fight by imposing the draft. They collect taxes from you. They impose a lot of rules on you, and they can change the rules. And that's hard for people to accept, but that's the harsh reality.
We're out of time, so we have to leave it there. Thanks for joining us, Scott.
Thank you.
And from the National Education Association, Rhode Island, Robert Walsh.
Thanks.